Hi, welcome to this episode of Debt Wired. I'm Joe Yu, Deputy Managing Editor of Debt Wire Europe. On this episode, we speak with Sam Whittaker, co-head of Lazard's Europe Restructuring and Liability Management Group, and his colleague, Tom Howard, co-head of European Debt Advisory. They are going to talk about a number of wide-ranging topics on debt restructuring and distressed debt in Europe, from the evolving role of the financial advisor to how documentation is affecting restructuring negotiations and the way private credit is impacting the fixed income landscape. Sam, Tom, thanks for joining us today. Sam, to start off, let's talk about the restructuring activity so far this year. How does it compare to the market's expectations at the start of 2023?
Thanks, Gio, and thanks very much for asking us onto this podcast. I think when we sat here at the back end of 2022 / the beginning of 23, I think the dislocation in the credit market had taken hold, you know, following the war in Ukraine and spikes in yields. And I think we were all expecting 2024 to see a material pickup in the restructuring activity and the number of restructuring transactions. I think where we are today is things are playing out a little more slowly and a little more gradually than people had anticipated. It's fair to say there is still a large amount of distress in a kind of general terms in the market, a lot of fragility within corporates. But that has not led, at least to date, has not led to a large wave of what we might look at called sort of traditional loan-to-own heavy-duty restructurings. We have seen more restructurings in the small to mid-cap space, where companies are perhaps more fragile, sponsors or owners of those businesses have less resources to protect investments, and where the documentation tends to be more floating rate in nature and therefore more vulnerable to increases in rates. More quickly, that transmission mechanism is probably more quicker in that side of the market. And therefore, you know, I think there have been a fair amount of sort of restructuring and insolvency. In the large cap sponsor and corporate space, I think we've seen less activity. And we've also seen sponsors and owners looking to protect their investments through the provision of additional financing if there's liquidity needs and such like. The sectors where there has been activity, there's been more activity in more targeted sectors rather than general waves. So, for example, I think the real estate sector, which is obviously very correlated to the rates environment, has started to see lots more kind of distress. Cyclical industries such as chemicals, building materials have started to come under pressure, and we're seeing more restructuring opportunities in those sectors. Similarly, you know, we're now following the transmission mechanisms, if you like, from rates to real estate. You're seeing an impact on the house building sector. What's quite interesting, taking house builders for an example, though, is how these things hit in different eras. So when we went into the global financial crisis, the leverage within house builders was very, very meaningful. I think, you know, this time round, there are very few issuers that have actually retained meaningful amount of leverage. That is to say, I think a lot of people learned their lesson in 2008, 2012. And whilst those businesses are under pressure, they have cash flow and liquidity issues. Some of them, they don't have as many of them don't have large scale balance sheet sort of issues. So, you know, net, not as much activity as we thought, but in certain sectors, we're definitely seeing a pickup. And, you know, this sort of cycle has yet to play out fully. So I think, you know, as we travel through the end of this year into next year, we're expecting to see more.
And many companies have been able to push out their debt maturity walls in a wave of amend and extend deals that we continue to see. According to DebtWire data, borrowers have pushed out the maturities of 24 billion euros of first lien institutional term loan Bs in the first 6 months of the year alone. Most of these will now mature in 2028. How are the borrowers able to get lenders on board?
I think it's an interesting question, and you're right. I think if we look at the overall, you know, sort of market volumes that we've seen in 2023, the majority of them, either both in the, you know, the loan side, as you say, about the amend and extend exercises, but also on the bond side, have been, you know, around refinancings or extensions of maturities. You know, if you look at the majority of those, I'll let Sam comment on, you know, perhaps those that have fallen further into the sort of rating, down the rating threshold, but the majority of those still hold on to, you know, single B, you know, ratings, and, you know, are backed by, you know, in most cases, you know, quality sponsors and businesses which, you know, to all intents and purposes have continued to, you know, perform. So I think when you ask the question of why are investors open to terming out, I think you still have high quality businesses, you know, in capital structures that, you know, as Sam said in his previous, you know, answer, haven't extended too much leverage. Now, clearly, you know, leverage levels kind of on average, you know, peaked up in new deals and new LBOs, as you saw kind of 21 and 22. But I think, you know, there's been a slightly defensive, you know, mindset since that point. So, you know, I think you fundamentally have a set of investors who, you know, are prepared to give the benefit of the doubt to, you know, quality companies on capital structures that are yet to be proven, I suppose, in the new interest rate environment. But, you know, would appear that they are going to survive through this period of time. And so I think, you know, when you look at those deals, there's a number of very significant, you know, sizable amended extends that have been, you know, put through. There are others that obviously have been, you know, more challenging or required a little bit more from, you know, the sponsors. You know, one example might be, you know, the sort of EG group, you know, which was sort of, you know, you could say, you know, required a bit of a reshift of kind of assets and so on, you know, to make that, you know, work out. But fundamentally, you have a solid single B, you know, credit, and ultimately the market wants to support those. And that's what we've seen, I guess, through 2023.
Yeah. And look, just to add from the restructuring and sort of more liability management sort of perspective, I think the first thing to say is that a lot of issuers dealt with their problems in 2021 when the market was very much open. So, you know, a lot of these, you know, either refinances or kind of light touch A&Es were done in that context. Clearly, as we traveled through 2022, the market shifted dramatically and people found it harder to get away unless they, you know, either had some sponsor support or were in industries or companies that were by and large in sort of rude health. Of those more challenging A&Es where perhaps they didn't hit the market at the right time or the sector's been more structurally challenged, etc., a number of deals have nonetheless still got done. I mean, we're still in a market which is heavily dominated by, you know, the CLOs and institutional real money bond funds, and neither of which are, you know, typically geared up to invest, you know, unless they have to, the time and effort involved in restructuring a business and taking ownership. We're just not really kind of in that market in the same way that we were in 2008 to 2012, so to speak, during the financial crisis. So I think people's desire to go down that route is, you know, much more open to A&Es than perhaps they were then. And then the toolkit is also important when thinking about this from an issuer side. You know, there are ways to encourage amend and extends through up-tiering transactions, drop-down exchanges, and, you know, the like that we've seen probably more of in the US historically, but, you know, you're nonetheless starting to see some of these sorts of transactions in a European context. And we've seen, you know, sponsors support businesses. I mean, you know, you saw on Hurtigruten, you know, TDR putting in money to try and get that amend and extend away. And then look, you've seen certain situations, you know, where an agreement's sort of not been, you know, they haven't been able to get the A&E away. I mean, Keta's probably a good example where, you know, ultimately there was a short-term A&E, but really it's a bridge to a sale, as we understand it, you know, and there are other situations that have led to perhaps more fulsome restructurings. But, you know, certainly, you know, people are running the traps on the A&E first, you know, before kind of defaulting, as it were, to a sort of restructuring, which is more kind of, I think, seen as typically a more last resort option for both issuers and to a large degree lenders too.
Okay. Tom, you've been advising clients on raising financing. What are some of the trends you are seeing in the private and public credit markets?
Sure. I mean, I think it's probably helpful in answering that question to maybe sort of segment down my answer, because I think what we're seeing, you know, more so now than ever before, is a real differentiation in terms of access to markets, access to credit, you know, both in the scale point, but also jurisdictionally and I guess sector by sector, you know, as well. And I think you see all of those things playing out. So it's hard to sort of answer that, you know, generally speaking, but I'll do my best to sort of fit it into that. I think probably the first place to start is, you know, what do we see in the middle market, you know, which has obviously been dominated, and I'm sure we'll mention private credit a few times, you know, on today's, you know, podcast. But, you know, we see the sort of middle market sphere over recent years, and then we still see it, you know, today be kind of dominated, I guess, by, you know, the private credit direct lending, you know, funds. I think, you know, at the kind of ground level, you know, what are we seeing and what's playing out? I think we actually see a lot of selectivity in the markets. I think there's, a bit of a flight to quality, for want of a better way of putting it, or at least that's the perception, I suppose. You see the majority of the deal flow moving towards the business services, the TMT, the healthcare, sectors. So still, good, healthy demand around those sectors. I think where we've seen perhaps a harder or a bit of a lack of supply is in the older, let's say less loved, sectors, where there has been, notwithstanding the sort of glut of liquidity, I think people have become, more selective, and deal flow has been harder around those subsegments. But equally, I think we also see that the bank market actually in certain jurisdictions probably lost out on a number of deals, actually started in some cases to kind of fill in a little bit the, the gap, albeit, probably at lower leverage, levels. But, we still see that on some of our, deals today, bank clubs actually still playing a part in, what's otherwise become much more of a sort of private credit market. So I think, if you look at the middle market, it's selective, still liquid, but it's certainly not the kind of rude conditions that we saw going back a few years before, the rate shift occurred. I suppose if you kind of look across then to the larger end of the market, some interesting dynamics at play. And obviously, again, I mentioned private credit, before. Interesting, couple of interesting dynamics, I suppose, that, aren't new news, but we continue to see them play out. One is, private credit going larger, and you see that for, new money deals, but also, refinancings, as well, like the Finastra, deal. But also, you see private credit, sitting and being helpful alongside what I would call kind of more public, transaction structures. So sizable positions, alongside perhaps a more liquid TLB or high yield bond. And so, in a way, that's a sort of hybrid use of private credit. And then I think, most interestingly, I suppose, in the take privates that we, are increasingly seeing, obviously private credit plays a role in that, as well. And so, I think we're still seeing a fair bit of appetite to, follow sponsors, Ergomed being probably the most recent example, but there've been a whole series of, take privates that have been funded into the private credit market. But I would say, post summer, there's a big wall of money, liquidity's there. I think the technical for kind of new issuance in TLB land and in high yield is strong, but obviously the supply hasn't been, coming through. And what I can say, generally speaking, is that we have seen a pickup in banks' willingness to underwrite. And you can see that even at the jumbo level, for example, on the Worldpay transaction that's come in. Now, clearly that's been structured to a fairly conservative capital structure. It has a pair of double B, ratings on it, but certainly we see the willingness for the banks to kind of step back into the underwriting market, which, hopefully helps to bring a bit more supply, into the public side. But, overall, I would say the public market in our mind is certainly open, depending on, the sort of nature of the clients. But private credit is obviously giving it a run for its money, across the spectrum. But I would expect as kind of, as this quarter kind of opens out, that, maybe we see a bit more of a, resurgence into the TLB market, just simply because the pricing differentials seem to be kind of widening, again, and you start to see some of the repricings that are happening in the dollar market, and you start to see a little bit of that happening in the European market, as well. And it's difficult, I think, for the private credit market to compete, as of now, with some of those price, those price points that are getting printed, albeit they've been few and far between.
So how do you expect this to change the dynamics between companies, creditors, and advisors in getting a restructuring deal done?
I think there's a number of differences in the current environment than we've seen sort of historically. The triggers that typically bring creditors to the table are much less than in historical periods. So historically, where it was more of a loan market with financial maintenance covenants, you would have seen creditors typically come to the table earlier once EBITDA or profitability was deteriorating. That might trigger a maintenance covenant that would mean a discussion happens sort of quite early. Equally, the security packages associated with LBOs, let's say during the financial crisis, were again much tighter. So where companies had liquidity needs, the need to get lenders' consent was sort of, you'd almost always need it. It was much harder to put new money in that wasn't equity, should we say. In the current environment, there are very few triggers on the financial maintenance side, covenant side. I mean, there are sometimes springing covenants in RCF facilities, etc., but by and large, much of the bond market is incurrence covenants only, and there are all sorts of baskets and carve-outs and abilities to raise finance against unencumbered assets or using baskets, restricted payments or permitted investment basket capacity in order to be able to get new money into the structure. So what that means is, you know, the performance of a business can deteriorate, you know, for quite some time, and you can even have liquidity needs. And in that context, have lenders sort of not needing to be in discussions, or creditors not needing to be in discussions with the borrower. And that does create, you know, opportunities for sponsors and owners to sort of kick the can, you know, without asking consent, so to speak, or without having to have a conversation. I think that that poses challenges for creditors in terms of they may be very anxious and want to solve a problem, but not able to because, you know, the company doesn't need to have a conversation with them. So I think that that dynamic has sort of shifted quite a bit. I think the other dynamic that's shifted is, you know, given, and picking up on Tom's point, given there is still a large amount of capital available to be deployed. Again, very, very different to the financial crisis, which was a genuine credit crunch. And, you know, there was not a lot of liquidity around, despite the fragility that's currently in the market, and the spike in yields that we've seen to varying degrees over the last 12, 18 months. There nonetheless remains a large amount of private credit and capital available to fund. So where you have liquidity holds, if you can find the right assets and against or the right collateral, people are willing to fund. And frankly, there are also funds out there that are willing to fund on a subordinated basis if the sponsor doesn't have access to capital themselves. So again, that lends itself to a situation where resolving issues, unlike 15 years ago, which was typically, you know, between the lender, you know, and the borrower and the owner, third parties can be part of that mix and provide capital as part of a solution. I think the third difference that is almost a function, if you like, of those first two elements is the fact that where businesses have had to restructure, and there has been that big discussion between stakeholders that are invested, i.e. creditors and borrowers and owners, that's often been in those sectors that are most challenged, which have found it harder to raise third-party capital, to attract capital, to come into the situation, to be part of the solution. And obviously, you've seen that, you know, in the retail space. And, you know, we saw, obviously, Wilko's probably one of the most recent example of that. But, you know, last year, there was Matalan restructuring. You know, previous to that, there's been, you know, a whole slew of sort of more hardcore restructurings in that space. And I think that's partly reflective of a very challenging sector that hasn't been able to find a kind of solution absent a restructuring. There's some of the differences and some of the challenges. I think that that also plays into the solutions and what you need to do as an advisor, and the need for, frankly, a broader toolkit that goes beyond just understanding, you know, how to negotiate a debt for equity swap. I think understanding documentation and flexibilities within documentation is super important. You know, at Lazard, we've been, you know, probably at the forefront over the last 10 years around liability management techniques, many of which were sort of developed by our team in the US and are now being used over here. I think a capital solutions capacity within an advisory arm is also important to be able to identify and bring in third-party capital to be part of the solution is also a key element and a key string to the bow. And then thirdly, you know, in an environment where we're not, you know, necessarily expecting a hockey stick recovery, as, you know, because credit markets are going to suddenly, you know, as we saw in 2008, and, you know, from the financial crisis to sort of, you know, 2015, let's say, you know, and beyond, we saw a huge bounce back driven by not just a recovery in the real economy, but also just the benign, increasingly benign credit markets, which created, you know, a V-shaped recovery for a lot of capital structures and businesses. I think in the absence of that support, solutions for businesses and for creditors and for investors being taking part in restructurings may well be more strategic in nature, which may require M&A and strategic initiatives rather than just sort of fixing the balance sheet and hoping that everything in and of itself will just recover and you make money that way. So I think that's certainly one of the lessons we're finding in situations we're involved in, is bringing together both the analytical rigor around documentation together with the capital solutions angle, as well as M&A in a sort of more holistic option, is a key part to sort of finding solutions in the current environment, which is obviously different for the reasons I laid out earlier than say 10, 15 years ago.
And Tom, is there anything you want to add to what Sam just said?
Perhaps the only point that's worth mentioning, just in relation to the challenges of restructurings or getting through amend and extends, is just understanding, you know, the creditor base and what's important for the creditor base. And what do I mean by that? I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, a lot of the debt is still held with CLOs, and obviously ratings and sort of understanding the implications of ratings on those CLO vehicles, you know, is an important part of, you know, the exercise, because it obviously to a degree kind of dictates, you know, how people behave. And I think the other part of that is obviously, you know, if you look at documentation and where it's been, you know, whitelists, if you understand what I mean by that, the ability for these guys to kind of trade and to whom, you know, a lot of that has sort of flexibility has been taken away. The sponsors have been, you know, very robust around having those whitelists. And so I think, you know, when you look at the challenges, sort of you have to look both at the company side, you know, what are the solutions for the company and what's best for the companies, but from a creditor point of view, what enables, you know, creditors to continue to have conviction, continue to be able to technically hold, you know, these investments, you know, that is also, I think, a key part of, you know, the landscape, and I think not to be underestimated.
Sam, Tom, thank you for sharing your views with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
To our audience, thank you for listening to DebtWired. I'm Jo Yu. You can download or listen to more episodes of DebtWired on Apple and Spotify.